My name's Marianne. I am an alcoholic.
Marianne.
I promise not to do.
Hi, Lisa.
My daughter's here too. It's awesome. Okay, my sobriety day is August 12th, 2012. I just celebrated my 5-year anniversary. Came here and picked up my chip, and Bill got me and said, "Will you speak?" I'm like, oh, golly. I've given my story once before up in a much smaller venue. I now live in Jasper. It's called Pete's Porch. I'm wearing heels so y'all can see me. So my feet might get really sore after a while. But a little bit of my history. I was raised with non-alcoholic parents. My parents were very normal. They'd have a glass of wine here and there. Once in a while, I saw my mom tipsy at weddings and stuff, and it was pretty funny, you know. But I had a great childhood. I was raised in Mayberry. You could go anywhere, do anything, you know, get on your bike. Everybody knew you. No fears, nothing like that. I did have an alcoholic grandfather that was pretty much kept from me. He died when I was fairly young, but I had found out later that he was an alcoholic. I still carry, you know, everybody feels uncomfortable in their skin. I still feel that I am that little girl who at about 5 years old had to go to kindergarten with buck teeth, crooked bangs, and a patch over my eye with cat-eyed glasses. That's my self-image that has always followed me. But I know that's not true now. But I do go back into that little, that's where, you know, that's how I had to present myself when I first went to school. I also remember, like, when I was 12 years old, and this is an alcoholic thought with a 12-year-old, and I wasn't raised with alcohol. I was lying on the lawn with my best friend, Judy, and we're looking up at the clouds, and I remember telling her, I said, "You know what, I'm never going to drink or smoke pot because that stinks, but if I do anything, I'm going to do pills." Where would that come from at 12 years old? I didn't know pill poppers. I didn't know there was such a thing as pill poppers. But I had that thought. And that's just kind of really, really weird. But thankfully, I have never been addicted to pills. When I have had them prescribed to me, I used them as prescribed, and that was it. My first drinks were of Matus wine. I grew up with next door to a first-generation Italian family, and we would drive down to Passaic for the Sunday dinner. I was raised in Connecticut. And they would have Matus wine at the dinner table. And I remember my mother telling me, "You're Catholic. You had your confirmation. You cannot drink till you're 21. And I was always a goody-two-shoes. I did whatever my parents said. I just never got into trouble, and it was, but you know what? There's the family, have a glass of wine, everybody's having a glass of wine. And you know, I didn't care for it, it wasn't much of anything. And then in high school, I remember walking down to the Rocky Hill Fair, and my parents had some whiskey up on the top shelf or something, and we got two Coke bottles and probably put half a shot in them. And we were big girls going to the fair. It was I didn't get a buzz, and I didn't get effect from the wine, nor did I get an effect from the whiskey. Actually, it was quite disgusting. So, drinking was not one of my things. In 1977, I met my high school sweetheart, and we went to college together. And that's when I met Matt. And through college, I bartended and drank a little bit. You know, didn't really care for the booze. I was pretty much heavy into the weed then. You know, that's what we did. You know, if I tasted beer, it reminded me of moldy, sweaty tennis socks. I don't know why, but it was just repulsive. And and I took the 6-year plan through college, graduated with 144 credits, only needed 120. It's because I changed my major so many times because I guess, the weed kind of took over my mind and I couldn't grasp a lot of the subjects. But one of my classes in college was a painting class. I majored in art and minored in secretarial stuff because I knew I wasn't good at art, so I had to get a job sooner or later. So I had a professor who was the dean of the arts department that would encourage us to bring pot brownies to class so we would be more creative and can paint better. I did get a blue ribbon on one of my abstract paintings, so maybe he had something back then I didn't know. I worked three jobs, and my last semester of college was just one class, a shortened math, and I lost math when they added the alphabet to math. So, I mean, you're talking, you don't put letters in numbers. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So it was a statistics class, and like I said, I was working three jobs. I was planning on getting married in June, and this is May, and I got a damn D in the class. And I had to go to that professor, and I cried. I said, listen, I have 25 credits more than I need to graduate. I suck at math. Please give me a C so I can graduate. And I did. And 4 days later was my wedding. So it was a pretty hectic time back then. I got married in June of 83 after 7 years of dating. It was, you know, we had to get through college on my time, but that's okay. You know, we had normal early marriage stuff. We were a team building a family and welcomed our first son in 83, second son in 87, and my daughter in 1989, who is here with us tonight. I remember sometime in, like, 1988, living in South Florida, and my husband was at work, and we only had one car, and it was the fugliest car. It was a AMC wagon, three on the tree, lime green. But anyway, we were thankful for the car. At that point, I think I was working at the Holiday Inn with a 4-year degree, which really stunk, and he was a waiter. So it was one day, and it was really hot outside, and I opened up the refrigerator, and there were two choices in the refrigerator to drink. One was baby formula, and one was beer. So, and the third choice, I should say, was lukewarm brown Lake Okeechobee tap water. So that was a no. So I opened up one of my husband's beer with a shot glass and proceeded to acquire a taste for beer. Further down the road, like in 1990, I acquired a job that I truly, truly loved. I was given the opportunity to be a judicial assistant paralegal to a federal magistrate judge in West Palm Beach. The commute was really hard, and I had two kids in preschool and one in elementary school, but my husband didn't want to move. He had his own business and a too friendly secretary, who is now his wife after 24 years. In 1999, my judge's husband, who was an FBI agent, was investigating a company that my husband was working for, and I was asked to resign due to a conflict of interest. I was really devastated with that. I loved that job. I was going to make a career out of it. Benefits were awesome. My judge was a lady judge. She had horses, and on non-court days, we'd go to her farm and ride. I'm a horse lady now. I blew up birthday candles for 45 years before I got my first pony. So I did leave with a wonderful gift from the judge, and that was my love and passion for the horses. And I'm so very thankful that I do have them now. In 2000, we moved to Georgia, and I did not know a soul here, not a soul. And I was told that I was going to be a stay-at-home mom. Ugh. God, the travesty. You know, my wine started a little bit earlier every day, and to the point where, you know, it became full-time. It was pretty sad. I have driven drunk many times with my kids in the car. My daughter reminded me of something today that I truly did not remember, so I must have had blackouts. I thought I was a functioning alcoholic, and for the most part, I was. My watch isn't done. You know, it was awful. I know that when I first came into this program, they said, change your playmates and change your playground. I was a stay-at-home mom that drank at home. What the hell was I supposed to do? I mean, don't go to that room. I mean, it was, I just, you know, it was tough. 2003, we'd often go to our cabin in Murphy, and I knew, which was the intuition that used to baffle me, that another woman had always been in my home. You know, a woman knows where she or her stuff was last and how she folds things and so forth. And, you know, I did a little searching, and public records because we had moved from Florida. I wanted to make sure all the deeds were, you know, paid off and everything else. And I had found that my husband had signed a warranty deed for this secretary. I was given the explanation that we were just friends, she's a widow, blah, blah, blah. And I have to tell you, when I moved to Georgia, I had such a sigh of relief. I said, so-and-so is finally out of my life. She was not. She was not. And I drank over that. I drank over the lies. I drank over the hurt. I drank over the pain. I'm the one who put the bottle to my mouth. Nobody else did. But I drank over that. And that's what I used to call justifiable. Justifiable is the word I'm looking for. Anger, resentment, justifiable. Soon thereafter, I became married to the bottle. I was no longer a wife. I didn't care. My oldest son was pretty much off to college at that point, but my two younger children who were in high school saw the effects of it and unfortunately had gone down the same path, but their path was not of alcohol. It was heroin. My daughter is sitting here today. She picked up her white chip last night. I am so very proud of her. My daughter is a winner. She's had very good sobriety. She went to Cobb County Drug Court and was one of the stellar pupils of drug court. But as everybody knows, this disease talks to you. And she ended up having a relapse. You know, it's going back to finding that warranty deed. That's when my drinking went into full gear. I was angry, resentful, and hurt, all justifiable. But, you know, I'm an alcoholic, so there is no justifiable anger. Otherwise, it kills you. On June of 2003, on my 20th wedding anniversary, my husband and I went to Atlantis. It was our first vacation without children. Second day I was there, I got a phone call that my dad died in Connecticut. And he was not ill that I knew of. So that kind of killed the vacation plans quickly. I went up to his funeral. We got out of the Bahamas, got up to Connecticut, and I was pretty wasted through that whole ceremony, that whole funeral. I wasn't a fall-down drunk. I was one of those maintain, except for when something was bothering me. But by that point, like, everything was bothering me. You know, it's just, I got, you know, that my dad had passed away, and it was the night before Father's Day. And I remember going through the airport, either in Bahamas or Fort Lauderdale. My dad's name was Larry, and I'm in the airport, and my husband had to go get Nathan's hot dogs because he loved Nathan hot dogs. And there was a gentleman running down the, not the tarmac, but inside the ticket stuff, yelling, "Larry, Larry, Larry, wait for me." I was like, oh, my God, that's my dad's name. But, I mean, it's just little things like that that stick in your mind. At this point, my husband had given me the gift of some horses. I loved my horses. My horses are what kept me alive. If I did not have the job to have to get up every day and feed those animals, I would be dead. I remember going to feed. I would have to stop either at Kroger one day, Publix another day, TNT package store different day, because I didn't want anybody to know I was drinking like that. Oh, my God, you know. Where did I go yesterday? I always made sure I had enough wine in the morning so that I could get to the barn with a new bottle of wine. I mean, it was awful. It was just awful living like that. 2008, my drinking progressed as it did. I had found my middle son hanging in the front yard in a total blackout. I was offering the ambulance drivers wine. You know, normal people don't do that. Drunk people do. My daughter reminded me of that today. I had forgotten. It was, he survived it. But just the things that you do that you don't know that you did, and you're like, oh, my God, you know, really? Seriously? I did that? Another time he OD'd. My son has had a long history of abuse. Another time I remember him having to go in and get the charcoal pumped in his stomach, and I couldn't leave unless my big cup was full of wine. I took wine to the hospital. That was normal. Didn't everybody do that? I thought everybody did that. In 2009, another woman appears and calls on my daughter's birthday, proclaiming to be my husband's fiancé. That wasn't good. That was really a hard one. 3 days later was Christmas. My husband gave me a 38 special for Christmas. He's either a brave man or a stupid man. I don't know. He gave it to me so that I could go camping with my horses and fill each other one with snake shot, one with a bullet, in case somebody ever broke into my camper. That relationship with the fiancé ended a few months later. I had no self-esteem. I didn't know who I was. I could not fight for my marriage. As much as I loved my husband, I was with him for 33, we were married 33 years and dated 7, so 40 years. But, you know, 3's a crowd in a marriage, so that marriage was long gone before I would even admit to it. Sometime in 2010, my daughter found me in my room at my lowest point. I had the 38 special loaded in a bottle of Xanax. I was going to kill myself, I think. I don't know if I would have. I value life too much, even in my darkest, darkest times. But, you know, your children aren't supposed to find you that way. And I don't know if she ever told anybody, but I put the gun away and flushed the Xanax down the toilet and just proceeded on in my little drunken state. In 2010, 2011, but what year was it that you said you came? I thought it was like 2010, 2011.
Like
05. You moved here? Okay. Well, anyway, I was drunk back then, so I don't know my date. Our friend Matt was offered a job through my husband, and we opened our home to him. By then, you know, my communication with my husband was really non-existent. I would have to prime myself for him walking through the door because I didn't know if Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Hyde was coming in. And, you know, in retrospect, what came first, the cheating or the drinking? It really doesn't matter. It became a vicious, vicious cycle. Who wants to come home to a drunk wife? And who wants to be married to a cheater? I mean, that was our life. Anyway, Matt came in and lived with us. And Matt was not the Matt that I knew growing up. Matt was a rogue. he and my ex used to, man, crash cars off of cliffs up in Rocky Hill. And I remember them going down to look for a job in Marriott. And my ex left me a red Pinto wagon with New York plates that was unregistered. And he took my new Mustang. I mean, That's what we did, you know. Anyway, Matt came and stayed with us with his wife while his home was being built. And like I said, this wasn't the Matt that I knew from 30 years prior. He had something that I wanted. He had a peace. He had a serenity. He just had something that I had never, ever seen, not only in Matt, but in any person that I knew. It was just awesome. Needless to say, while he was living in my house at the time, was like living on eggshells. Poor Matt's wife would run downstairs when my ex-husband would come home because, like I said, it was just a screaming, barking dog. But I would see Matt go into the other room with a blue book and read. I'm like, what the heck is in that book? I have no idea. And when the times got really tough in my home, which was not a very peaceful house at all at this point, with 2 active kids that were in addiction and a drunk wife, he would say, "I got to go to a meeting." I'm like, okay. But not once ever when Matt lived with us did he say, "Mary, you're an alcoholic." He would say to me, "You know what? you're drinking, I think you're drinking, you may be drinking a little bit too much. It was suggestions. And he planted the seed that life was better. But in 2011, I wasn't ready to give it up. I saw it, but the seed was planted, but I didn't think I could ever get there. And for that, I'm thankful that God placed them back in my life. In 2011, in March, I went on a week-long camping trip with my older horse, my beloved Ringo, to Florida. I was a wine drinker. I liked vodka, but I knew vodka, you know, would kill me. Wine wouldn't. I had a nice big handle of Kettle One with me in my camper. I was going to go all out that weekend. But I wasn't feeling well. I was just, you know, I was at the point where I was shakes every day. I would drink in the morning to throw up so I could drink again to get rid of the pukes. That was my everyday experience. I became very ill on that trip, and my poor horse lost 100 pounds. I loved that horse. He lost 100 pounds because I could not care properly for him. I managed to haul this big rig home. We're talking a big F-250 and a 30-foot horse trailer with a bottle of wine next to me through Atlanta, through Florida. By the grace of God, I didn't kill anybody. I don't know how. I had someone watching over me the whole time, and I didn't realize it. When I got home, the next day I went to the hospital. My stomach was extended. I looked like I was pregnant. I'm like, something's really wrong with me. And I'm going to say a funny story. You know, being an alcoholic, I've always had high blood pressure for 30 years. And I wouldn't go to the doctor because I was afraid of what they would say. So I got online and I ordered my damn blood pressure medicine from China, paid $300 because I was damn going to take care of this heart of mine. Forget the liver. That, you know, I had to make sure my blood pressure was okay. That's stupid. That's insane. But that's what I did. I was diagnosed with pancreatitis and major liver disease. I think that my liver was probably at a 50% function when I went in there. The day after I got out of the hospital, I was in there for about 4 or 5 days. I don't remember too much of it. They had me pretty well drugged, probably to detox. But you know what? They never suggested a rehab for me, which I found odd. They told me to go to a meeting. So I came to the ladies' meeting here at Sober at 6, and I sat there, and I looked at all these women. I never had a DUI. I never got arrested. I have 2 cars in the driveway. I have a nice house. I did not have a damn thing in common with any of you people. So I didn't go back. I picked up that white chip, and I didn't go back. I was still in so much pain from the pancreas and the liver and the extended stomach that I white-knuckled it for 90 days. I did not take the advice of people to say do 90 and 90. Well, you know what? I was unique. I wasn't like you people. So I white-knuckled it up for about 3 months, and I took a ride up to North Carolina and found my husband back with his secretary. And I threw everything to the wind, cursed all the way home, and bought a bottle of wine. I was in such a state of torment. I bought that wine with the doctors in my voice, in my ears, saying, you'll die if you drink again. I threw that bottle of wine away. Next day, I bought another bottle of wine because that voice was so strong. F it, have a glass of wine, because that's my MO. That's how I masked my feelings for so many years. I took a sip, threw it away. Next day, half a glass, threw it away. It was pure hell. Until finally, I bought that bottle of wine the probably fourth day and drank the whole bottle. So here I was, you know, back to drinking again after being told I would die. You know, I swore that I would never drink again without this program because I was in so much pain. And any women here who have ever had a baby, you have a baby, you pop it out, and you swear to God you will never have another baby. Guess what? You pop out another baby. It's just the way it is. Well, it's happened with me. In August of 2012, so this is a year later, and I had been drinking, my husband was on Sturgis with yet another companion, My marriage was officially over by then. We were just roommates. It wasn't a very happy place to be living. And I had been drinking for that year, and I saw that it was getting to the point that the shakes had not yet come, and the puke in the morning and the drink and just to get ready. But I was almost there. And when he came home that Sunday, I told him I had started drinking again, and he said, "I know." You know, we think that we're fooling people, but we're not. I remember having to gather all those wine bottles, and I put them in a garbage bag and said, "How the hell am I going to dispose of these things?" I went down to Blankets Creek, which is up here on Sixes Road, and I said, "I'll dump them in there." Well, they were having a damn bike rally there. I couldn't do that. So, you know, I really don't remember how I got rid of them. But the funny thing is, that Sunday after I said that I had been drinking, and I was very angry at him for taking a companion with him, I decided to go back to that ladies' meeting, that same one that I saw all the differences. And it's funny. I sat on that back deck all day long just praying to God, listening to the birds and saying, "Please, please, please take this away. I'm going to die, and I don't want to die." I sat next to Susan. She gave me her business card. And what shocked me was that in that meeting, there's half a dozen of the women that were there a year and a half before. I'm like, oh, my God, you know, they're still here. I took the cotton out of my ears, and I realized that I was just like you, and just like you, and just like you, and just like you. And I knew I was home. I had the gift of desperation and the gift of willingness. And that was August 12th of 2012. So that's my drunkalogue. I hope it wasn't too long. Now I'm going to talk about sobriety. Attraction rather than promotion. I am so thankful for that. Matt, like I said, was the person who planted the seed. I have a woman up in Jasper who told me that I was her walking big book. And to me, that is one of the biggest honors someone could say to you. She was also one of my drinking buddies, riding buddies. And the Bent Tree Saddle Club is a drinking club with a riding problem, and they think that's and they laugh about that, but it's so very true. I mean, to talk about a whole bunch of drunks, I are. When I first got into recovery, and every time the ex walked in the door, I could just feel my whole inside just tense up and tense up, and I found this serenity prayer. I had heard it before, but I didn't really know it. I Googled it. I taped it to my visor. I taped it in my laundry room. I taped it on my computer. I wore that damn prayer out, and that prayer saved my life. I just said, "God, grant me the serenity," every time he walked through the door. Because my marriage by this point was just, it was ugly. It was ugly. It was just ugly. I got a sponsor who began with the big book, and 6 months later, I remember going up to a Holly Springs meeting, and we were doing reading something either out of the big book or the 12 and 12, and it said, "Immediately you should start the steps." Well, I'm 6 months in, and I'm doing the big book and not the steps. So this wise woman says, "I think I need to change sponsors," which I did. I got a sponsor who I believe I was her first sponsee. We went through the steps. It was a little rough, but we did get through them. And in hindsight, maybe I should have stayed with the first one, because I can look at my old big book, and she knew everything. There were so many side notes on that big book. I wish I had stayed with her, but it doesn't matter, because the program worked for me the way it did, and there was a reason why it went that way. You know, and some of these things, you know, I'm a big one on these little stupid sayings on the wall. At the beginning, everybody says, "Oh, God, they're so stupid. You know, come on, think, you know, whatever." I remember in one of my first meetings, I heard, "You schedule your life around meetings, not your meetings around your life." That's one of the things I heard when the cotton was out of the ears. I still, to this day, do 4 to 6 meetings a week. I go to Ball Ground. I come down to sober at 6 because I got sober in that little room back there. And I do Peace Porch. If I don't go to meetings, I am not right. I am not right. I have lived by myself, so oftentimes going to a meeting was my only social interaction. And I so needed to be around people that were like me. I needed to hear. I needed to just listen and share. This week has been a big AA service week. And I just realized that. I chaired a meeting Monday. I chaired a meeting Wednesday. I chaired a meeting last night. I'm speaking today. I guess I'm good for the year. I don't know. I'm kidding. But when I'm asked to do something in AA, I say yes. That's what I was taught to do. That was suggested to me. I was taught to do that. In August of 2013, my one-year anniversary, my husband and I were splitting up and breaking the house down. But before that, I picked up my blue chip in Asheville, North Carolina. Why was I in Asheville, North Carolina? I was going every weekend to visit my brother in hospice who was dying from this disease. He had bladder cancer and smoked, but he was still drinking his vodka. You know, he was a wonderful guy. Very peaceful, very calm, but he had the demons. I remember going to, it's hard to hold someone's hand when they take that last breath. But I was at peace with myself because I had my program. I went to that meeting picking up my very first blue chip, my year chip, and I told them why I was there at that meeting, and I said I did not have to drink over my brother dying. I did not have to drink. I want to go back to when I first got sober. I was a fan of Vex NA beer and free wine, F-R-E, alcohol-free wine. Man, that should taste bad. But I had to do it, and my wife sponsor, the first one says, stop romanticizing the drink. And I was, because when I camped, I always had a beer. Around the campfire, I always had a beer. And on the real special camp trips, I had the Kettle One, but I don't need to do that anymore. And here's another one, God doing for me what I could not do for myself. After my brother died, I had the undaunting task of cleaning out the family home and moving to Jasper. I was hurting for the loss of my marriage and the loss of my brother. This was the first time I ever dealt with HALT, another one of our little acronyms here, hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. I was peeved because I was cleaning that house out by myself. My ex was going to the Apple Fest with his then girlfriend, and I was madder than a hornet. I had the case of the effets all the way up 575, all the way up, going to Trout's. I'm going to Trout's, sat in that parking lot at Trout's. And again, one of those, would I have gone in or wouldn't I? I don't know. But the funny thing is, as I sat there and contemplated whether I'm going to throw my sobriety away after not drinking, holding my brother on his last breath, and all the good that had come from that year of sobriety, I got nudged on my phone with words with friends. And that nudge was from Susan. That told me, go home and play Words with Friends, don't drink. That, to me, is not a coincidence. That's one of those things that I needed to hear. I pulled out of that parking lot and said the serenity prayer. Thank God for that prayer. I stuck with the winners. I have wonderful friendships now in this program, friendships that I could never imagine. A group of us gals in Pete's Porch, a woman has a vacation home in Hilton Head. Six of us alcoholic women went to Hilton Head. There was no gossip. There was wonderful fellowship. Experience strength and hope. It was one of those wonderful times I ever had. Never would I have dreamed that I could get six girlfriends together or go with six girlfriends and not someone getting into a fight, someone not drinking, someone, you know, some cat fight, somebody, you know, mad. You know, it's this program working through all of them. It was almost like a sabbatical. It was one of the best experiences, and I would not have experienced that had I not been in this program and continue with this program. It took me 2 years to do my eighth step on my ex-husband, or for my ex-husband, with my ex-husband. I chose to do it in written form as our communication. It was just talking at each other. There was no listening. The communication had broken down that much. You know, it was a real difficult task keeping my side of the street clean. I cherished my marriage. I took my vows very, very seriously. But I was angry. I was bitter. It was real hard to say, I drank because you. I drank because you. And for a long time, I was a victim in that marriage. Or so I thought. And once that pen started flowing, writing, and keeping my side of the street clean, it was a 3-page letter, and a weight had lifted off of me so great. It was, you know, it's hard to do a letter like that. But I would advise people that do it in person instead of a letter, because his wife, his now wife, which was the one, the friendly secretary from 23 years ago, read it. But you know what? There was nothing in there that was bad. It was all about me making my amends to him. How sorry I was that I drank through the marriage. How sorry I was that I was unable to communicate. I have always felt that I was someone's wife, someone's mother, someone's daughter. I didn't know who I was. I could not communicate. I could not communicate with the man I lived with for almost 40 years. He was a stranger. I was a stranger. But, you know, I wouldn't change anything for now, because another quote from Susan was, it took every single drink for me to get in here. And that is the truth. You know, it came from the heart, and I did the best I could. And whether he understood the seriousness and the graveness of it is really none of my business. I got it done, and I don't have to do that again. But I do have to say, you know, my mother was a very resentful woman. She was kind, but she hated the house my dad built. And all you ever heard is, I built this house for him. And I never knew what resentment was. So, you know, this wonderful program, this big book, has a couple of prayers in it. And one of them was that I had to say, and I'm going to say it how I used to say it. And this was how I had to say at the beginning towards my ex. If you have a resentment you want to be free of, you will pray for the person, the thing that you resent. It will set you free. If you will ask in prayer for everything you want for yourself to be given to them, you will be free. Ask for their health, their prosperity, their happiness, and you will be free. Even when you don't really want it for them and your prayers are only words and you do not mean it, go ahead and do it anyway. God damn, I wish that he was happy and prosperous. And I said it, though. I said it. You know, after, and I say it for 2 weeks. Well, I had to say it for a month when I finally said, you know, I really do wish him happiness, prosperity, health. Because when he's happy, the shit doesn't roll down to me anymore. And that's, I'm sorry for cursing. But I do still have to go back to that prayer, because I am one that would love, I love to bring back my resentments. I love to chew on them just a little bit more. And unfortunately, it's your family that really knows how to push your buttons. And this one is the master button pusher, if I allow it. I heard another gentleman say in Jasper, he's since moved to Florida. He said, you have to put your shield up. Put your shield up. So I pretend I'm Wonder Woman. Go away, go away. I wear Velcro. I don't wear buttons anymore, so they can't be pushed. But, you know, I do find that I have to go back to that prayer, especially when I start getting, I feel like I'm being antagonized. And the prayer does work. It brought me peace. It brought me serenity. It's really, really a good one. And going back to resentments, I love to take them back. I give them to God, and I take them back. That's my MO. I'm an alcoholic, and I love to chew on those old hurts. But, you know, I know now to let them go. I don't let them hang around for a long time. I try to, I discuss it. I'm not a very good sponsee. on real bad things, I do call my sponsor, but I am one that shares in all my meetings. I don't hold on to things. I let it out in the meetings. Another one that I learned from Susan was let God let go. She had told me the story of when her husband was killed, and she was able to let God let go. And I'm like, what? How could you? I mean, mentally, how could you do that? Not bad, like, how could you do that? But, how did you do that? I remember one night my daughter called me. She was in probably the worst in her addiction. And when I hung up, I cried. I thought I would never hear from her again. And I prayed and I prayed and I gave it to God. And she didn't call me the next day till about noontime. And I was sure that she was dead. I was sure she was dead. And I got the phone call. She says, Ma, didn't sound good, but she was alive. The power of prayer is there. It's absolutely there. And I want to thank Susan for showing me what let God let go means. Another quip from Susan. I already said that. The quip from every drink got me into these rooms. I write down all these little quips. I've got quite a few from my buddy Buzz. I love Buzz. Buzz has taught me so much. One of them is, it's an inside job with outside help. Wow. Yeah, but 8 words, and it's so true. I couldn't do this alone. I could not ever have done this at all. I wrote big. It just looks like a lot of papers, but it's like one of those term papers because I can't see. You know, I've been using another phrase that I've learned in AA, which is, if I'm not the problem, there is no solution. I get caught up in other people's problems, and especially in my family. Right now, there's a horrible wedge in my family. It breaks my heart. Whether it will ever straighten itself out, I do not know. There's too many parties involved. I do hope it does. I pray it does. But, you know, I'm not in control of anything. The only thing I'm in control of are my actions and my thoughts, which will bring me to page 417. I'll read that one real fast. 417, see, these are my 2 worn-out pages on my book. And, you know, 417, as you all know, is the acceptance prayer. And acceptance is the answer to all my problems. Today when I'm disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, or thing, or situation, some fact of my life, unacceptable to me. And I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it is supposed to be at this moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. Until I could accept my alcoholism, I could not stay sober. Unless I accept life completely on life's terms, I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world as to what needs to be changed in me and my attitudes. That is so powerful. This Wednesday, I'm going to close up real quick. This past Wednesday, when I was chairing up at Pete's, a gentleman came in. His wife was just killed in a car crash the day before. And there was a newcomer, and actually it was someone who had come back. He had been sober for several years, and he was describing his anxiety. And that gentleman who had just lost his wife gave the most profound advice to this guy. He wasn't wallowing in his loss. He was helping another alcoholic. I get goosebumps thinking about it. He was so humble, and his words were so clear. And I just sat in awe watching this program work right in front of me. Last but not least, I have to say I've met so many wonderful, wonderful friends. I have met my boyfriend Ed in this program. He keeps me grounded, tells me to breathe. I don't breathe very well, I guess. He's taught me to look at clouds. When I look at clouds, I don't think of, I think I'll do pills one day instead of drink or smoke. this program saved my life. The people who are the walking big books, who do the attraction rather than the promotion, you just don't know whether you are the seed that plants this beautiful program into other people. And on my last note, don't quit before the miracle comes. That's all I have.